Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. You know, we ended the last episode with this plea for joining the conversation and stuff like that. And one of the things that we did get a question from one of our listeners, and it was essentially around the concept of, and I didn't do my homework this morning, so I don't have it right in front of me, but one of the question's gist was, is there, what's the strategy to design for the minimum viable reliability?
Yeah, that's a good question. It comes up. I remember this going back into the early 1990s at General Motors, and we would have questions like that, and there were various guidelines. Back then, there were some guidelines, in fact, in the late 80s, early 90s, of, you know, a 95% reliability, but that was a test reliability. Mm-hmm. You have to achieve this based on a certain number of samples and certain confidence level, that type of thing. And then they'd say, yeah, but if the part was critical, we'd have to get a 99% reliability. But then they would add in things like but we would use a 99.8 percentile customer user. Mm-hmm. So you go on
kind
the,
of worst,
you
know, case,
what are the extreme
kind of
worst case, yep, yeah, temperatures and cycles and things like that.
Yeah.
And so you get different guidelines, but there never is, and there probably should not be, one answer that says, here's the one reliability you need to achieve. And I think we can talk about why that is, and unless you think there is one number.
Oh, yeah, I do. It's just that we don't know it. Is, let's say you have 10 customers total for your entire production, right? You have 10 individual customers that are going to get your year's production, and you're going to make 10 items. The hard part here is that the minimum viable reliability is defined by those individuals that are using your product, right? For them, if there's a failure, they've experienced a zero reliability, right? They had one unit and it failed, and they might have enjoyed it for a month or 2 months or 10 months or whatever, but they had a failure. So they experienced total unreliability, or to some degree. And even if 9 out of the 10 had no problems whatsoever, that one doesn't really care what the other 9 had. And the complicating factor here is they all will probably use your product differently and define failure differently. And in the design process, we often talk about reliability and allocate and do all kinds of stuff and set goals and do all these other things and tie it to business and this, that, and the other thing as an attempt to get our arms around about what we think maybe, hopefully, those 10 customers actually want.
Yes. I didn't hear from that the reliability number.
Oh, no, there's no number. It's remember, see, I define reliability as it's in the mind of the customer. If they say, hey, it's the wrong color, that's a failure of the design team to pick the right color, right? It's a failure. It's returned. It's deemed by the customer as failed, even though the color has nothing to do whatsoever with its performance. I'm thinking like a car. My yeah. wife actually, she said, oh, you go get a car. And I go pick one and it was the wrong color. So I took it back and swapped it out for another car.
So this is a really interesting topic, which is starts out with what is a failure?
Right.
Because a failure could be, And we could define it as, doesn't meet requirements.
But that's our construct internally. That's not
right.
The customer.
Exactly. And so what a failure to a customer is whatever it is. In other words, they don't. And now I'm going to break it down even further.
Okay.
So we're kind of brainstorming with you, but I can break it down further, which is there's a failure that the customer doesn't like, but they're not going to do anything about it.
That's right.
Then there's the failure that the customer doesn't like, and they're going to bring it in as a warranty issue. They're going to call an 800 number.
Or they're going to go buy your competitor's product and badmouth you for the week on social media.
Yep. Yeah. So you have gradations of customer defined failures or experience failures, ones that they'll just sort of tolerate, but they're not really doing anything about, or ones that are going to cost the company money because they're going to return the product. Mm-hmm. And then you have the internal, like you say, which is doesn't meet requirements in some way. And that's an internal one. So different gradation, different definitions of failure. And one of the first things you have to do with when you're on any reliability program is to agree on what the definition of failure is.
That's right. And that's where you hear it more in the quality folks, is they're the voice of the customer kind of term, right? They're representing the customer's point of view. And I think reliability people need to take up that banner too. It's one of the questions I ask my graduate students each year is what's the most major expense, or I probably worded it better than that. What's the biggest expense of reliability? And usually that gets, and I rephrase it, I think, is the unreliability. What's the biggest expense of a failure? And almost always it's warranty or testing or, you know, scrap or, you know, the time it takes to do failure analysis and so on. And all 99 out of 100 students say it's an expense to the company making the product. No. The largest source of expense is to the person that bought your product, hoping to derive some value for the $10 that they spent. They hope to get $100 worth of value out of it, and it fails. And so they are deprived of the benefit that they had originally bought your product for. The classic example is your server goes down and your online store can't take orders, and customers go other places to buy whatever widget it is you're selling, and you've just lost a day's sales. And it was because of a $2 power supply failed.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So I'm thinking as you're talking here, to reframe the question. Okay. So when a listener says, what's the minimum acceptable reliability, that's I don't want to say it's the wrong question, but that question could be misleading. Because what we want to do is say, what's the reliability requirement? So it opens up the very important task of setting good reliability requirements. And good reliability requirements, look at what the definition is. You fit into what's the intended function. You define also the intended usages, the operating conditions and conditions of use. You define the time. You define the probability or the ability to achieve. So you've got at least those four aspects that have to be defined, and they need to be agreed upon by your company, because your company is going to take into account the different costs. They should take into account the potential loss of customers. If the customer is not satisfied, which goes beyond the warranty expense, because you could have a much greater expense of losing customers. Yep. It should take into account the very important aspect of safety. And so you got to drive safety your goal should be zero safety problems. And so all of that comes together in how you define the requirements. And so I would never look to what's the minimum acceptable reliability. I'd say, what are the reliability requirements that meet our objectives as a company?
I agree. Yet you and I have both sat in design reviews where it's kind of the launch decision or those discussions in teams, and they say, is this ready to go? And it's combination is all the marketing in place. Do we have all the collateral in place? Do we have all our talking points in place? Supply chain all geared up, ready to go. And is the factory retooling and ready to go? And then somebody says, well, is it reliable enough? Right. And in a lot of the work we do in setting goals and setting all of this interpretation of what we believe the customers and the business balances of what's good enough or what's expected, we got to answer that question at some point, saying, well, it's good, it's reliable enough. And it varies by industry, by product, by amount of risk you want to take, all those kinds of things. But it's not a game to get it just reliable enough. And the only reason I say that, it's not the aim. And I like the way you rephrase it. What are we trying to achieve? What's the objective? Is that there's too many uncertainties. And we need to put a margin on that. It's not.
Yeah. I've sat in countless meetings that have that subject that you brought up there. Are we okay to proceed?
Mm-hmm.
Is the way you might phrase it.
Right.
Can we go to the next, through this gate and into the next phase, which might be production, what have you. And one of the reasons I learned early in my career the importance of reliability requirements is because of sitting those meetings unprepared. Early on in my career, where I sat in those meetings and I thought I knew what I was doing, but somebody asked it and I go, well, maybe it is, maybe, you know. No, you need to have reliability requirements agreed upon early in the product program. They drive a lot of the other tasks.
That's right.
And those requirements, when they ask you, are we good enough to proceed? The answer is, have we met the requirements?
Well, I'm thinking, to make it concrete, I'm thinking of one of your early projects was testing doors. And I'm just thinking there's probably a requirement for a hand crank to roll the window up for a certain amount of force to be applied to that and within a range. And there's probably human factors tables that says how much force does the average human exert to turn this crank and things like that. And if you did testing and found that only Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime of weightlifting could actually get the window up, right, you could say there's a 98% probability that our customers will not be able to roll the window up given the expected distribution of strength of people's arms. Here's a hard fact. Here's our testing that shows it. Here's our requirement that said the average, you know, the 10th percentile strength person should be able to do it. And we're not there. And we're going to have this many failures of customers getting the car wet because they can't roll the window up. You know,
yeah,
but that's what you mean, right? If you don't have the requirement, then you have, well, it's hard to crank up. Well, how hard? Well, kind of hard.
Well, let's explore what you said there. And I think you're adding a good insight into this, which is you don't want to be just a yes or a no person. You want to say that here's the consequence to the organization and the customer if you do proceed. And first of all, I think you should be very, very firm if you see any potential safety issue,
mm-hmm.
and because that's a different path. So I taught my reliability engineers many times. I use the visual characterization, putting your body on the track.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to take a stand.
Yeah.
If you see something that's not right, that's a very important part of the job. You're not just a friendly person that gets along with everybody. If you see something that's not right, you have to take a stand. But now, that assume that that's the case. But now let's get into what about reliability issues where they're not safety related, but they're going to be aggravation, that type of thing. Now, instead of just saying yes or no, you can say, here's the consequence. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost this amount of money in the first year. We think it's going to be, we're going to lose this number of customers. This percentage of people won't be able to crank the window up. I think you should be data-driven and be able to converse with management on what the consequences are,
mm-hmm.
of going forward if something doesn't meet the exact requirements that are laid out.
And we're never going to have all the data and all the testing and so on. I think that comes back to, or we've discussed it many times, is, well, how do you set up a plan? How do you account for the uncertainties? And where do you focus your testing or simulations or all that work with, that's all part and parcel of it. So that when you get to the end of the day, you can say, yeah, here's the evidence. And here's, I think equally important though, is here's the uncertainty. You know, it's not a confidence level. I've been having that discussion with a few people, is that just because I use so many samples, I get a confidence bound about my regression, for example. That's not the same as the uncertainty is, did we even do the right test?
Yeah, I know many people in management that get confused about confidence intervals,
right?
Because you look at the Webster definition of confidence, and that's not the same as the technical definition of confidence interval.
What it comes back to is that we'll get that question: is how confident are you that it's ready to ship, that we can proceed, is that it's reliable? Well, that's not a question about the confidence interval up on our regression analysis, our test sampling. That's a bigger question of, are we covering all of the significant risks to the reliability performance of this product? I had one of my students ask this question the other day, they were working with a company, a medical device company, saying that if we do a change to anything in our supply chain, our manufacturing, or the design, we have to retest everything. And I thought,
well, oh my goodness,
that's an odd policy. It's very conservative, yeah. But I think it actually misses the point. Because if you don't understand what's the ramification of that change, you may or may not know if you have a test that even is relevant to it. You could repeat all of this stuff and not do the right thing.
and you get, and similarly, you get policies like everything gets an FMEA.
Right.
It's the same kind of thought process.
Right.
But here's another way to look at this for listeners. Nothing can take the place of a good reliability plan. If you have a good reliability plan that has the right tasks, it's based on the right gap assessment, and it has the right reliability requirements, then you can go about your work to complete the tasks and do them well, and because that's what's going to get you to a position where you have confidence in the meeting that says, are we okay to proceed?
Right.
If you've done a good job on the reliability plan and you've done the tasks and done them to a certain quality objectives, then you're saying, yes, we are okay to proceed. If you haven't done that, there's going to be some uncertainty.
Well, there's always going to be uncertainty, Carl. I think it's going to be, you're going to be unprepared to answer questions, and it's going to be just a gut call of going, well, I think it's good.
Yeah, I think it's sort of good. Yeah.
I'll buy one.
Finger up.
Yes. I'll buy one.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's not binary, but your level of confidence is going to be less if you don't have a good reliability plan.
Well, it's early on in my career, I got to work with a medical device company that was struggling in the market. Their reliability performance was bad, and they knew it was bad, but they didn't know what to do. So I got involved with working with them. And to make a long story short, we did all kinds of stuff. We put a plan together. They executed vast majority of it. I was kept on working with them through the process. And then I got called back at the start of their next product development team. That same team then rolled over to a new project. And I got invited back to talk to them and get them started on that. And I asked, whatever happened with product, you know, XYZ? I haven't heard anything about that in the last 6 months. And they said, well, we kept waiting for the customers to start complaining because the almost every other product we shipped, they complained within a week. And, you know, the first week went by and then a month went by and we started calling customers to find out were they even using the product? Maybe our product's reputation was so bad that even our sales weren't being used. And they started receiving comments that, oh, no, it's great. We love it. You know, it's working like it should. Why would we call you? You know, kind of thing. and then they said, that's when we decided to call you back and to set up that plan and teach us more about how to do it ourselves. But it was never a question of minimal viable reliability. They never thought they were creating the just acceptable. Even when we did a competitive analysis, it wasn't to say, well, we need to be as reliable as these other ones. We need to learn how they solve particular problems. And it also helped us identify types of failure mechanisms this team wasn't aware of and trying to solve. And so it even when we did a competitive analysis, it just wasn't a focus on we need to get just good enough. And there policy changed from we need to improve our reliability to we need to be good at hitting the reliabilities our customers expect. And I think that's the attitude rather than, well, if we can get by with 69% reliable over the first year, then we're good. No, you're not.
this is such a hot topic. I was at a company a couple of years ago that focused their reliability efforts only on their first year warranty. Mm-hmm. This is a product they expected to last 10 years, but they had a low end warranty on it, and that's completely misguided. And so you have to there's more to this topic than just what we've talked about so far. There's other depths to it. In fact, we've gotten this far on the podcast, Fred, and we haven't even talked about predictions.
Oh yeah, well, let's not go there.
because there's a lot of pressure on reliability engineers. Okay, so what do you predict to be the reliability? And then they'll pull out a handbook and say, well, it's going to be this or that.
Yeah. Well, even with our, you know, doing modeling and default tree analysis and block diagrams or various models, and we're going to get the various distributions for the power supplies, dominant failures, and so on. Well, we can get a very sophisticated model, do physics of failure type stuff. It's this a guess. You know, it's a better guess than the handbooks by far, but it's still, it's just a fancy guess in my mind. It's
this. So you the have work. To be good. Go ahead.
You have to be good. And I think I'm stealing the words from you here, Carl, is that you have to be good at anticipating what are the things that your customers are going to define as failures and what's important to, mitigate or minimize or expose or understand and design out of your product. I always call it the red flags syndrome. As I go and start exploring a new product, and sit down with the team and go, all right, well, that's a new material. That's a new, anything new, basically. This is the first time we've ever done this, or this is a new customer base. So it's right out of that reliability goal statement. If it's new in any of those four elements, that's a red flag. We need to pay attention to that. And
yep.
So, and there's more sources of flags, I suppose.
Sure, there are. And so what I was going to say, and it sort of complements what you're saying, you have to be good at understanding the assumptions that go into, if you're in the prediction space, you need to understand your assumptions, you need to understand your limitations, and you have to be good at characterizing those.
Yep.
And I don't just mean disclaimers. What I'm really saying is you have to state, here's what I think based on this assumption and within this limitation framework, here's my best estimate. And you can say that type of thing, but I would always include what the assumptions are and what the limitations are as part of it.
That's right. So back to the original, what's the minimum viable reliability? It's essentially what's good enough for your customers and your business. And the hard part is it is always changing, and it's variable by individual customer. So we use internal things in order to structure a ability to answer that question. What's good enough? You know, and it's company policy. Do we want to be middle of the road, or do we want to be pack leader or low cost leader or whatever?
Absolutely.
It fits in with that structure, yet it's always governed by our customers. And so hopefully we got the point across, Carl. That is like, look, it's a little more nuanced than just saying, how low can we go? It's not a game of limbo.
I don't want to get in that game.
Yeah.
And like you say, you're based on the customer, but then you want to get it as good as you can. And make in other words, you want your integrity to be in place, that you're doing the very best job you can. And then, like you say, you have to interpret what the customer needs are and interpret it into company things like reliability requirements and reliability program plan, things like that, as the way you go about meeting the customer needs.
Yeah. Well, so we'll wrap it up there. It's, if you've got some point or ideas of this or a similar type of question or even frankly, a different question, that's fine. But if you'd want to weigh in this discussion, head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and there's a contact form. Carl and I are both on LinkedIn, and our contact information is also available on our About pages at Ascendo. But it's, Carl, this is our 572nd episode for Speaking of Reliability.
That's awesome.
It is. And I'd say on the order of probably 200 to 300have been sparked. The discussions have been sparked by listener comments and people that pose questions to us. And some we get from our clients in just our experience. But I haven't been keeping track, diligently enough. But I suspect that ratio of our listeners chiming in is getting better and better. And we certainly look forward to that. So I just thought I'd mention it. But yeah, 5'72". We haven't found a lack of discussion points.
That's true. It keeps going.
Yeah.
So, well, good conversation, Fred.
All right. Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you again. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.